Okay, quorum being present, Committee on Local Government and Elections will come to order Wednesday, February 15. Members, we are resuming our discussion of Senate File 1577 from a previous meeting. Senator Limmer moved the bill before the committee. Before we begin, it's our intent that we vote on this bill before 2:45 today, no later than 2:45 p.m. So we'll follow Senate rules regarding decorum during the hearing, no clapping, interrupting, heckling, things like that. We'll be respectful. So I think we're ready to start. Senator Newman. Okay. In order to stay on time, we may limit testimony to 1 minute or comments or talking. Senator Newman, you have an amendment, the A-16 amendment, is that correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, the A-16 amendment would be the current version that I would like to work off of.
This is an author's amendment. Can
we adopt? Mr. Chair, I could move the A-16 amendment.
Senator Limmer moves the A-16 amendment. Discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A-16 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendment's adopted. Senator Newman, would you like to just explain some of the changes in the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me begin with thanking the committee members for all of the thoughts and the questions that they had, and the various members of the public that came forward last week to testify. I found that to be very helpful, and what you are looking at with the A-16 amendment is the result of not only the discussion that we had last week, but also as a result of me revisiting the Crawford case, which I'm going to discuss with you a little bit further in a few minutes. The testimony that I was listening to last week from various groups and individuals that came forward seemed to be bring forward two different issues. One was the issue of voter fraud is not a problem. And the other was that the fact that they may be required to produce a valid ID is a burden on certain groups of people. Now, in terms of voter fraud, I've thought about, bringing in, the personal anecdotal stories that I have heard and many of you have heard from constituents. But, those are always based on hearsay and really don't carry a lot of weight. I've also thought about bringing in articles such as one written by Mr. Spakowski and published in the Heritage Foundation in March of 2008. But we really don't know who this guy is, and we don't know if his, if he really knows what he's talking about. So what I decided to do, rather than try and convince anybody that voter fraud does in fact exist, is to go to the Crawford case. And for the purposes of the record, I just want to indicate that I'm going to be referring throughout the course of my testimony today to Crawford et al. Versus Marion County Election Board et al., which is a U.S. Supreme Court case that was decided involving an Indiana voter ID bill back in 2008, and it's authored by Justice Stevens. And specifically on the issue of voter fraud, I think that this is really a pretty good source of information on which we can rely on. And specifically, Justice Stevens finds that voter fraud is a documented problem that has occurred throughout this nation's history and has been supported by historians and respected journalists throughout the course of our country. In other words, Justice Stevens.
Senator Newman, I'm told they're having trouble hearing you. Some people are having trouble hearing you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try and get into the mic a little better. I will wander off, I'm sure, but and I'll do my best to get into the mic. But Justice Stevens, what he's saying here is that, and this is coming from the U.S. Supreme Court, voter fraud is a matter of historical record in the United States. And then he goes on to say this not only occurred or may be occurring in the state of Indiana, but he also cites in a footnote, examples come from California, Washington, Maryland, Wisconsin, Georgia, Illinois, Pennsylvania, Missouri, Miami, and St. Louis, not to mention Chicago, that all of us have heard about. So at least in my mind, given the language in the Crawford case, the issue of whether or not voter fraud is a problem, in my mind, is resolved. It is a problem in the United States. To the second issue that we talked about or we heard about last week from the various folks who came forward to testify, that forcing them to produce a valid photo ID is a burden on them. And I believe that that is true, that it is an additional burden on that segment of the voters. But I also think that we somehow have to balance that additional burden of requiring folks to produce a valid ID against the need to protect the integrity of our election system. And I also think that this issue was effectively resolved by Justice Stevens in the Crawford case in his discussion where he outlined and specifically addressed some of the folks that would presumably have a difficult time or at least an additional burden in obtaining the voter ID. And I will come back to that in just a minute. But as to the Crawford case itself, the Crawford case was a case involving in-person voter impersonation. And that, of course, is in large measure what we're talking about here today with this voter ID bill. But in addition, Justice Stevens spent a fair amount of time discussing other election process issues. And in the course of his discussion, he identified that the state does have an interest in protecting the integrity of our voting system. And he specifically mentioned three different points or criteria that were important to him. And the first was that it's important for the United States to improve and modernize its election process. The second point that he wanted to make was the voter ID requirement will prevent voter fraud, which, remember, he has now recognized as a matter of historical precedence. And then the third thing that he mentioned is that it is important, an important element for voter IDs to protect the safeguard of voter confidence, that the more confident our voters are in our election process, the more likely it is that voters will participate in the democratic process. So those are the three points that he was making, sort of an overall general concepts. And to me, those are very important general concepts in terms of proceeding with what we are trying to do with this bill. Justice Stevens spoke directly on the issue of the additional, or I should say, the burden on voters in requiring them to come forward with a valid photo ID. And he rather ineloquently grouped us into two different groups. Most of us, and a smaller segment. And what he said was that for most of us, and I suspect most of us just sitting here right here in this circle, would simply be required to pull an ID out of our billfold and vote. And for most of us, that is not any significant burden. But he recognized the additional burden on a smaller group of voters. And he went so far, Justice Stevens went so far as to take judicial notice of the fact that this is an additional burden on a small segment of our voters. And when the court takes judicial notice on something, that's important. That's as a matter of law. They recognize it, whether or not evidence is presented. So to me, that was a pretty important statement by Justice Stevens. But then he went on to say that for most voters who need gathering the required documents, it isn't a substantial burden. That's most of us. But he takes judicial notice that that a somewhat heavier burden may be placed on a limited number of persons. And then he went on to identify who those persons are, and they are the same people that sat here last week and testified with us. And he's talking about the elderly, the homeless, those who have religious objections, the disabled, maybe folks who are unable to obtain a birth certificate. And what he then went on to say is that so long as this additional burden is not unreasonable, it isn't on its face unconstitutional. So Justice Stevens is recognizing that we've got two different kinds of voters that we're going to be dealing with in this country, most of us and a smaller group. But it's necessary, it's needed to protect the integrity of our system. Therefore, if we require an additional burden on this smaller group of people, so long as it isn't an unreasonable burden on them, then it is not necessarily unconstitutional. And it's with those thoughts in mind that I then, you know, both what I heard at the testifying table, what I heard from my colleagues in the Senate, and in reading the Crawford case, I went back and I revisited the amendment that we were working off last week, and that then brings us, members, to the A-16 amendment. And let me just, I'll just walk through it very quickly as to what I took out and what I stuck in. And I would indicate that the reason I did this is I'm trying to clarify the legislative intent of what we're trying to accomplish here. And it seemed as though no matter how many times I said it, there were still questions about, are we going to outlaw absentee balloting? Are we going to eliminate provisional balloting? That was never my intent. It is not my intent to disenfranchise anyone. It is my intent to protect the integrity of the system. So what I did was, first of all, I took out the language that just lumped everybody together as all voters. And I took it out because that's what Justice Stevens did in the Crawford case. And I went with persons who are voting in person and people who are not voting in person, because that's how Justice Stevens phrased it. I took out the words regarding the identical eligibility standards. You won't find that. And what you're going to find instead is language that talks in terms of substantially equivalent eligibility verification. And I did that in order to give the legislator a better opportunity to implement what I'm going to call a balancing test. And if I go to the Crawford case, Justice Stevens alludes to a balancing test. He doesn't come right out and say it in those words. But he does say that the general rule that even-handed restrictions that protect the integrity and reliability of the electoral process is not invidious and satisfies the Constitution. So the language when you see substantially equivalent, that's what I'm driving at. And the genesis of that thought is really coming out of the Crawford case. I have included language regarding provisional and absentee ballots. Here again, I went to the Crawford case for guidance. And I will tell you that initially when this bill was drafted, I did not want to put that language in the Constitution because I thought it was too narrow. And I've done a 180 on that. And I've given it a lot of thought. And given the concern of some of our members and concern of the public, we have no intention of eliminating absentee balloting. We have no intention of eliminating the ability to provisionally vote. So I stuck the language right in the amendment. Justice Stevens specifically talks about, for instance, provisional balloting solves the problem of someone showing up at the polling place without an ID. If you allow them to provisionally vote, that solves the problem of the lack of the photo ID. He also talked about the absentee balloting. Now, granted, when he's talking about provisional balloting and absentee balloting, it's in what's called dicta. It's not the main part of the case. But I really do think that it gives us a lot of guidance as to what the Supreme Court ultimately would rule on in a case of this type. I included language concerning when a photo ID is presented for purpose of voting, and what I have in mind then is you're going to present an ID when you vote in person, and I use the word provided with proof of identity, and that would be something that would be used in the absentee voting system. I've included language within 10 calendar days to allow someone to go back to the polling place or the courthouse or the auditor, whoever the appropriate elected official is, to give them an opportunity to present the valid ID so that their ballot would be counted. And I used 10 days because I don't want to go with such a short period of time that you effectively prohibit folks from presenting their ID, but I don't want to go out so long that I effectively am interfering with the election process. And the thought for the 10-day requirement, again, is coming out of Crawford. And here Justice Stevens is talking about whether or not the state's interests justify the burden imposed on voters who must make a second trip to the circuit court after voting. And I think what Justice Stevens is alluding to there is that it's not unreasonable to request in this day and age for someone to go back after having voted provisionally to provide proof of who they are after they have voted in order to have their vote count. Next, I've included a severability clause. In the ballot, you have not seen that before. That is new. I will tell you that I decided to include it because I got some mixed messages on whether or not severability clause is a good idea. And I can tell you that I did get a message from the revisor's office, Senate counsel, might be able to help me with this. I don't remember exactly how it was phrased, but suggesting it might be a good idea. On the other hand, if I go to the Crawford case, Justice Stevens alludes to the fact that a severability clause might not be necessary in order for the court to look at a statute or a constitutional amendment. So, you know, I've put it in the severability clause, but what I have in mind specifically is that I do not want to get caught in a position where a portion of this bill may be determined to be unconstitutional and we lose the entire amendment. And so for that reason, I put it in. The final thing that I added then was a change in the enactment date. If you recall, last time you were looking, I believe, at, I think it was July 30th, 2013. I will tell you that I'm open to suggestion on the enactment date. I changed it, and you are now looking at June 30th, 2014. For this reason, I've had local governments come to me and say, you know, this is really going to be a problem to implement this after the assuming the amendment passes and the legislature works on it and enacts a law next year. They need time to get set up. And it was suggested to me June 30th because of a requirement of mailing out absentee ballots. And they are requesting 2014 to give them time to gear up and do what they have to do between the time the legislature adjourns in 2013 and when June 30th, 2014 rolls around. I don't have my feet set in concrete on this. I mean, I would certainly be willing to visit about it and talk about it. I don't know if it'd be a good idea to have that discussion on the Senate floor and let all of the senators weigh in on it. But specifically, what I want to do is to do my best to cooperate with the local units of government so that they will be able to react in a reasonable and responsible manner to what I anticipate that the legislature will do next year if the voters in this state approve this amendment. So in a nutshell, I'm coming forward with this bill because I think that we need to modernize our electoral system. I do think that we have voter fraud in Minnesota, just like other states have voter fraud, and I want to try and do something to stop it. And I think that if we lend integrity to our voting system, we, in fact, will encourage our citizens to vote and to participate in the democratic process. And all three of those points are points that were determined and supported by the Crawford case. Mr. Chairman and members, I'll be happy to try and answer any questions that you may have. And so that I don't forget, I believe this bill is supposed to go to Senator Perry's committee next. And at the appropriate time, Mr. Chairman, I would appreciate an appropriate
motion. Before we go to questions, though, members, maybe we could have Ms. Stangle explain, Senate Counsel explain, the difference between the A-16 and the A-13 amendment that we had put online yesterday. Just so they're technical changes, we believe, but we wanted to make you aware of them. Ms. Stangle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at the A-16 amendment on line 1.13, it now says eligible individuals. In the A-13 amendment, it said voters. That same change was again made on line 2.2. On line 1.21 of the A-16 amendment, the phrase "or government-issued proof of identity" was added to mirror the language at the top to make sure that everything worked the same all the way through. And then on line 1.34, we took out the phrase "at the time of voting" because that relates to proving your identity with an absentee ballot, and that's not done at the time of voting in the language above. So you're just trying to keep everything consistent.
Thank you. Senator Sieben, did you have a question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for clarity, could you just, since I understand that part of this was posted online yesterday, but just so that the public has time to weigh in it, will you just go over again what you said about allowing testifiers today? Are you going to allow some testimony? or what?
The public testimony was concluded at the last hearing, so we're not going to be doing that. We'll be doing amendments and questions from members.
Mr. Chair, I think that perhaps because this is because of the severability clause, it now is adding the provisional balloting language into this amendment. That's substantially different than the bill that was before us the other day. I just encourage you to rethink that and perhaps allow limited testimony even from members of the public on this, because it's a constitutional question. It has vast implications, and there are differences between the bill that was offered last week that you reconsider that and allow the public the opportunity to weigh in.
Senator Sieben, I think we're going to continue with the discussions. If we want expert testimony from someone, we may take that briefly, but there's no way we could listen to and do service to the number of people here today and the amount of time that we have, and we are going to move the bill forward. We did take testimony on it as it was before. Most of these changes are technical, dealing with some of the concerns that were brought up at that hearing, but you know, we have heard the bill extensively, and we are going to move it out today. So, Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, on that point regarding, I think it is substantially different to have provisional balloting referenced in the constitutional amendment. And Senator Newman, you referenced that Minnesota now has provisional balloting, which I don't believe we do. So I'm just trying to wrap my head around how you envision a provisional balloting system will work under the proposal before us. If you could just explain that more.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Sieben, what I anticipate here is simply an acknowledgement that provisional balloting will be part of our Constitution. It will be up to the legislature next year to determine exactly how they're going to implement it.
You got to talk in the mic.
I'm sorry. It will be up to the legislature next year to determine exactly how they are going to implement provisional balloting. I think that provisional balloting is a matter of federal law, that we are required to have it. And I am suggesting that we put it in the Constitution because it is an important part of our voting process. And there are, I think, something like 20% of the voters come in on same-day registration. And with provisional balloting in place, they will not be prevented from voting. As to exactly how it's going to be implemented, I think that's up to the legislature next year. And you will hear me, Senator Sieben, repeatedly answering in the same way when I am asked, how are you going to implement this? It's up to the legislature as to how to do it.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Senator Newman. And I understand that that you believe that some of this will be up to the legislature, but on lines 1.21 and 1.22, it says that provisional and absentee ballots shall be counted, if presented or provided within 10 calendar days. We don't have provisional balloting in Minnesota right now. If you submit a ballot, if you're allowed to vote, you take the oath saying that you're eligible to vote, your vote is counted. So this is substantially different, where it's setting up a process where, yes, you might allow everyone to vote, but you're not counting their ballots. So essentially, you're disenfranchising those members whose ballots won't be counted. So this brings up a lot of questions, but I guess I'll start with, if you're out of the polling place, you're voting absentee then, say, Will this language require the voter to show up within 10 calendar days to provide proof of, to show their photographic ID?
It is not my intent that that would occur. It is my intent that the legislature would enact a statute which would require the absentee voter to provide proof of their identity in the absentee voting process. It is not my intent to require an absentee voter to go back to the polling place or the clerk of court or whatever it might be, and provide that identification after the ballot is cast, after it's mailed back in.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you. Just to follow up on that, say that you're a veteran or I'm a veteran serving abroad. Who are you showing your ID to? When right now they don't show an ID because you're mailed an absentee ballot and they vote and they sign an oath saying they are who they say they are. So if you're serving our country abroad, are you going to be expected to fly back to Minnesota to show your local election official your ID? Or how is that not substantially equivalent then to what burden or what we're asking other voters to do who are voting in person?
Senator Newman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sieben, it most certainly would not be my intent to require a serviceman to get on an airplane, fly home, and present a photo ID to an election official. The reason why I have the language in there of substantially equivalent is to assist the legislature in dealing with the absentee ballot. Most certainly I have in mind that someone who shows up in person to vote or shows up in person to obtain an absentee ballot would be required to show proper photo identification. But if you will look at the language that says government-issued proof of identity, the legislature is going to have to provide absentee ballots or absentee voters, those who are in the military or perhaps citizens serving overseas and are applying to vote by mail, they will be provided with a manner in providing the government-issued proof of identity. I do not intend that they have to come back within 10 days after the election and show a photo ID.
Senator Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions, one for you, one for Senator Newman. Mr. Chair, do you know after the next stop, is this going to go to transportation at some point because of the DVS potential component? I'm just curious, and you may not know. But
Senator Reinert, transportation has not asked for the bill yet from this committee, so I don't know if they'll be asking for it from the state government.
The second question, if you would, Senator Newman, on one of your last points is one that I think resonates really well. And I guess my question is around, as you move forward, are you open to continued input? I think you really listened to what everyone had to say last time, came back with a lot of these, a lot of those reflected in your amendment. But I guess the teacher in me knows that there's more than one way to get to a destination. And, you know, this the card versus a video voter roll and some of the other possibilities that might be out there. Again, and we talked about this last time about quickly being overcome by technology. And so I'm curious in your perspective on that. I am concerned that the current language really kind of proscribes us into one option that gets where you want to go. But it seems to me like there are other options that might get you there as well. And if this is going to be in the Constitution, which is hopefully a relatively stable document, I mean, are you open to that continued input as you make your next stop and then to the floor or wherever this bill might travel?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
Senator Reinert, the lawyer in me says yes. You know, I think always beneficial to keep the dialogue open. And I would invite you to visit with me and give me input as to how to make this better. If you will recall, in one of my opening comments last week, I really believe that we all have in mind the same thing. We want to improve our voting integrity in this state, and we want to encourage voter participation. We're trying to get to the same place, but not necessarily by the same road. So I will listen and I will visit with you, Senator. Yes.
Senator, thank you for that. We haven't had a chance to get to know each other real well, but you've always struck me as someone who is sincere in their intentions. So
thank you, Senator.
Senator Kulesh.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, I wish I had a copy of the decision that you've been quoting. One of the things that you didn't say, I guess, that kind of struck me when you're talking about how Justin Stevens says it's okay to have these rules and regulations, does he say any place in that decision that the state or those citizens that cannot produce the ID voluntarily give up their right to vote or address the fact that the state is limiting their ability or their right to vote in that decision, or does he address it at all in there? I haven't got a copy, so I don't know. And that seems to be one of the issues that we're talking about, who has the right to vote. Those that have the ability to jump through the hoops to get the ID or those that don't. And you're quoting a decision, and the decision is basically supporting your position that, you know, if you can't get an ID, you shouldn't vote, I think. And I don't know if it goes far enough. I don't have the whole decision in front of me. Could you just give me an idea how the justice dealt with the right to vote for those citizens that don't jump through the hoops?
Senator Newman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kulesh, the case that I'm referring to and relying on is I'm relying on the guidance from the U.S. Supreme Court in drafting this constitutional amendment bill. And the answer to your question is no. There's nowhere in the decision where Justice Stephen even remotely alludes to the fact that certain people should be disenfranchised. What he does talk about, and again I want to emphasize, that the Crawford case is an in-person voter case, but he talks in terms of, he's musing. It's dicta when it comes to absentee voters and same-day registration voters. And I think what he's doing is he's giving us guidance in that we have to recognize that this smaller group of people that I earlier mentioned does have an additional burden, additional hoops to jump through, in your words, in order to vote. But so long as we don't make those hoops, I think his words were wholly unreasonable, if I recall correctly, then the state's interest in protecting the integrity of their voting system will not necessarily fail for want of constitutionality.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, I had a follow-up. Or you get one question.
Senator Kulesh.
That's fine.
Did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, yes, I did, and that it goes more to the document than, let me get my. One of the things that I did some checking with my own local election officials in Richfield and Bloomington, and one of the conversations that we had was the increased need for more election judges because of the a provisional ballot box, because now they have to have a separate place for it, et cetera, and it adds an increased burden on those local units of government that are responsible for that, as well as possibility of needing more election judges just to deal with the verification requirements of the photo ID. You know, will the lines back up more? Those kinds of issues that they discussed, and one of the things that is concerning to me is that if folks vote for this amendment, that they will not realize that it's also a vote for an increase in property taxes in order to pay that, because that's the only way the local units of government can do that. And we have no fiscal note for the locals, although there's been a request made by Senator Marty to try to get an idea for what it's going to cost local units of government. I'd like to know, how you expect to address those issues, because the cost of this could be substantial, depending on which we don't know, because we don't know what the legislature, if this passes, is going to decide to be. If we're giving them photo IDs, how much is that going to cost? Is the local unit going to have to provide that through their deputy registrars? Or is the state of Minnesota going to provide that? Where is the money coming to pay for this stuff, these photo IDs and the election equipment and the extra judges, et cetera, that this amendment is going to cost?
Senator Newman.
Senator Kielash, I guess I'll answer the question in this fashion, is that there isn't a fiscal note with this because it's a constitutional amendment, and I'm not aware of any constitutional amendment that's had fiscal notes in the past. Will it cost additional sums? Yeah, it might. But I think that language in the Crawford case that talks about protecting the integrity of our voting system against known voter fraud is important to keep in mind. And finally, I would say that, you know, you were talking a lot about the additional election judges, et cetera. I don't know whether that's going to be the case or not. I can't tell you if it's going to increase the length of time that it's going to take to go through the line. It might shorten the period of time. I will tell you that I read a study not too long ago that showed that that Canada, who has a more advanced voter registration system than we do, we spend 12 times more money on average than they do per capita of their votes. So maybe by modernizing, as I am in part trying to do here, ultimately we will save money rather than spend it.
Okay, Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to address some of the concerns that Senator Sieben brought up. The first question was severability that I believe she brought up, claiming that this was a major element of a new idea or a new amended version of the bill. Severability is a presumption that's in all of our state statutes right now. We usually don't have to write it into our bills, and the courts have accepted that. However, there are times when the legislature wants to be a little more explicit and make absolutely sure that the courts, if there ever was a contest, that the courts would understand that there is explicitly written into a bill the legislative intent that there would be a severability clause. For those of you who don't follow this type of legal discussion, severability simply means that if there's one small thing that's found wrong with a law, you can't take the whole chapter out. It's just that portion that would be judged independent of anything else in the law. And so this is not anything that's a major element to this bill. This is simply a reference that the legislature is attempting to be just simply more explicit in the event that there would ever be a question discussed. The other question would be on provisional balloting. I think in the discussion that I had last year with the voter ID bill, and it seems like it's surfacing again, that provisional balloting is considered as by some to be some kind of boogeyman in the discussion. Provisional balloting expands the voting franchise of our citizens. Take, for example, a new Minnesotan who just moved into the state of Minnesota, maybe days before a general election. He doesn't have a utility bill. He may be out of state. He doesn't have a driver's license that shows that he's from Minnesota. He doesn't even know his neighbors yet. And if he goes to the voting booth under those conditions, he would not have an opportunity to vote at all in Minnesota. A provisional balloting opportunity would give him the right to get added, either get to know his neighbors so they could come down and validate his identity, or he probably won't get a utility bill in that short of a time, but there would be other opportunities where he could go and get a valid identification, maybe even update a driver's license down at the local DMV. So provisional ballots, in my opinion, and it was the opinion last year when we considered a bill, a statutory bill, expands the voter franchise. It does not deter the voting franchise.
Thank you. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Newman, thank you for responding to our concerns. I wanted to address the issue that you asked for some input on, and that would be the implementation date, June 30th, 2014. And I just wanted to double check because I'm not sure how far ahead of the August primary the ballots, the absentee ballots, have to be prepared and ready to go out. Is it 2 months or 8 weeks or I'm not sure. Who knows that for sure?
Senator Newman, do you know?
Mr. Chairman, if my recollection is accurate, it was indicated to me by one of the local units of government that it's 45 days.
45 days.
And that's what I'm trying to catch is the time period where the local units have to mail out these ballots prior to the primary, and that's why I picked June 30th. If that date is incorrect, I would certainly be amenable to changing it, but that's the reason I picked that date.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
And if it's 60 days, you would come within that time limit if you had a June 30th. Well, not quite. We might think of moving it back to June 1st, but I do like the 2014 date. I'll be honest about that, because I think it also gives us an opportunity to do a major educational campaign about what voters will be expected to come with when they come to the polls, and give them time to go and get their free ID if they don't currently have one. And so I'm glad that it's moved back a year. It would have complicated things for the local elections in 2013. Certainly, it would have been a very rushed process. This way, we can have a greater commitment to doing this right and educating people as to what they will need to bring with them. And I think that's important, and I really do appreciate that. So, whether it's June 1st or June 30th, 2014, I think as long as we are able to catch all of those absentee voters for that August primary is the main concern.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to respond to Senator Limmer, your earlier point, Senator Limmer, that I think you directed at me, I acknowledge the severability clause may not be such a dramatic new thing, but getting back to the provisional balloting proposal or the provisional balloting language that's in this amendment, that is substantially different. And I don't think, unless I'm mistaken, you were describing that provisional balloting would expand voter eligibility, but there's nothing in this legislation that would change the voter eligibility requirements. In fact, it's making them more prescriptive, which is saying that people need to show photographic identification as prescribed by law. Which brings me to a point, Senator Newman, could you just explain your understanding? What's the difference between government-issued photo ID or government-issued proof of identity? That's new language here. I don't know what the difference is.
The difference, and again, now I'm going to go back to what presumably you're going to be here next year. Hopefully I'll be here next year, and that's what we're going to address in the legislature, and we will define that. I believe that we can formulate a bill that will adequately define what is accepted as a government-issued photo ID and what is acceptable as government-issued proof of identity. And we define in statute things all of the time. I would anticipate that the bill next year is going to simply say, for purposes of government-issued proof of identity, the following
Senator
shall...
Senator Newman, let's stick to the constitutional amendment, not what the legislature might do or could do, because we know that they have to implement this, and there's no way we can do that here, or are attempting to.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sieben.
I'm trying to understand what the definition of this language is that's in the proposed constitutional amendment. Not, and I understand that the future legislatures could interpret that differently, but I think it's a fundamental question of what is a government-issued proof of identity. I mean, I understand there's variations that could be considered a government-issued photo ID, but I honestly don't understand what a government-issued proof of identity means.
Well, Senator Newman, wouldn't the next legislature be the ones to decide what that is? And don't we decide what it is now?
Yeah, that is my intent, and that's what I continually go back to, and I recognize that some members don't like that answer, but my response is the legislature will decide.
Senator McGuire.
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up.
Do you want to? I'll yield to my colleague if she wants to follow up, but otherwise thank
Senator
you, Mr.
Sieben,
Chair, for
follow up.
Recognizing
thank you,
me.
Mr. Chair, and Senator McGuire. Senator Newman, I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but at the last hearing I raised this issue of are we putting into our state constitution technologies, for instance, for prescribing a particular way of showing identification that may be outdated in the future. Senator Reinert touched on it briefly, but I agree with you and with Justice Stevens, who said that we should always be looking to improve and modernize our U.S. election system. And if we're going to be putting into our state constitution that you have to present an ID, I think that we're limiting Minnesotans in the future from being able to do just that, to modernize our election system. So that, just to offer something that many of us around the table have looked at in the last few days, if the burden is on the election official or on the government in that they have some sort of computer or electronic poll books that show someone's picture, then the proof is on the government to see that, or the election official to see the photograph on the screen and match it to the voter. That's something that is appealing to me, because instead of investing precious state resources into trying to get everyone an ID every time they move and they need to get it updated and it is unknown amounts of money, we're putting money into modernizing our election system into some sort of electronic poll books, for example. That's something that I think is a direction that we could perhaps find compromise around and move forward on. And, Minnetonka is doing something similar right now, and I commend the Secretary of State for talking about these things and encouraging us to look at these. But so I'm not trying to put you on the spot. What I'm trying to do is determine if the language in your amendment is too prescriptive so that you're tying the hands of future legislatures to say that you have to present a state-issued ID. Or could someone, as Senator Harrington can speak to this more eloquently than I can, being in law enforcement, but facial recognition software is becoming more widespread. There are school districts in the state of Minnesota that now use fingerprint technology to identify students so they don't have to carry IDs with them when they go through the lunch line. I'm just really trying to get at whether this government-issued proof of identity, if there's some flexibility there with that language, if that's what you're looking at, or if you firmly believe that people need to show an actual ID card with a photograph.
Well, the language says as prescribed by law, but I don't know what's confusing about that. Senator Newman?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sieben, I will answer your question by going back to the language, which talks in terms of substantially equivalent. And I believe that the legislature in the future will have the ability to adapt to the circumstances that you are describing.
Okay. Senator McGuire, did you?
Thank you. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate and acknowledge the work that you've done, Senator Newman, in trying to address the issues that you heard at our last hearing. And I do appreciate the last hearing, Mr. Chair, in which you did give the public testimony. And I am concerned that at a delete everything amendment that we have before us, that we are not taking public testimony. So I will have some questions, though, because we have an extensive audience here. And I know that there are people here that actually know more than I do about this bill, Secretary of State's office. And I know that there are organizations that work on this issue with stakeholder groups that are going to be affected by this legislation. So I will be asking them to come forward and telling us how they believe this new delete everything amendment will come forward. Mr. Chair, I appreciate the way that you've been running our meetings, and I just want to say for the record that this is a public hearing, as I understand it, and so I do believe that we should hear from the public on delete everything amendments and on important issues such as constitutional amendments. We don't have that many constitutional amendments that come before us. Since 1974, we've only had 27. We really need to take these very seriously, and we need to be very careful about what we do with these. And so I think it warrants, if it's two committee hearings, if it's three committee hearings, I think these are the committee hearings that we do need to take our time with and really ask the public. And it does bring me to a couple of my other issues, is that Senator Newman has brought up a case. You cited the Supreme Court case, Justice Stevens, the Crawford case, and I might note that he did not mention Minnesota in that list of states that needed some help. And so I'll ask you to yield when I'm finished here, Senator Newman. Though I am concerned about who is bringing this forward to you. Who is it that really thinks there is a problem with this, with voter ID and with voter fraud in Minnesota? I would ask you about that. But I do want to say that this case that you've been citing is as a basis for many of your arguments. It was not a unanimous decision. It was a case that was that did have dissenters in the Supreme Court. I'll just mention one of them. Justice Souter said the voter ID law is a threat, poses a threat of non-trivial burdens, meaning there are burdens in the voting rights of tens of thousands of Indiana citizens. So he dissented in that case. So you're using this as a case to support your reasons for doing it in Minnesota, but there are dissenters in this, and there's a very strong constitutional argument about against setting this in law. The Constitution of voter ID is being challenged in several states, including Wisconsin. It was blocked by the U.S. Department of Justice in South Carolina because it goes against the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and it was deemed unconstitutional in Missouri on the basis that it infringes on the right to vote. So there are many courts in the land and many states that are concerned about this being unconstitutional. And so I just want to make those points this has been the main basis of support for your arguments. And I cannot let it go about the cost, about who bears the burden. Senator Newman, Senator Roebling always actually acknowledged, too, there will be some cost. If we're giving free IDs, and I might say there's really no such thing as free. I mean, if it's a free ID to the person, it's definitely not free to somebody else. So there will be some levels of government that will be picking up this task, and it will pose a burden to local governments, to our citizens of our state, and we think it's substantial. So I know that you want the legislature to make a lot of these decisions, but I will just repeat, I think this is an issue that if you are concerned about it, it should definitely be done in law, in statute, not in constitutional amendment, if it's done at all. I have not yet seen by any of the testimony that there is evidence of the need for this. And I will still ask you who it is that brings this to you as to what issues you have. And then I will ask other members of the audience to yield. But, Mr. Chair, I am a little nervous that I might not get a chance to have the microphone again.
So I do have an amendment, Mr. Chair, if I could offer that amendment.
Members, if you have amendments, we could start them now because we are going to vote at 2:45. So Senator McGuire has an amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Pass it out. What's the number?
The number is SCS 1577A18. Mr. Chair, I'll just start explaining it while it's being handed out. Mr. Chair, I've been very consistent in my views, and I think a number of people in the state of Minnesota feel the same way, that we should not be governing by constitutional amendment. This is not the way to do business. We should be putting things, we're elected to be the to be the decision makers for the public. Constitution should be reserved for those very important issues, those very fundamental rights that we need to put in. It should not be on issues that definitely need a lot of work and that definitely need a lot of guidance in them. But I'm going to give us, our committee, the opportunity to actually repeal something we already passed that did deal with the constitutional amendment on defining marriage, which I absolutely think should not be in our Constitution. This is, we passed it last year. I'm giving us, in this committee, the right to do what I think most Minnesotans want us to do, which is to not put this on the ballot. So what this bill does is it takes out the bill that we passed.
Senator McGuire, we're not going to take up your amendment. It's not germane to the bill.
Pardon me?
It's not even closely resembling the bill, so we're not going to take up the marriage amendment here.
Pardon me?
Out of order.
Oh, yeah, but Mr. Chair, it's an amendment to this bill, though.
Are there other amendments that members would like to propose?
Mr. Chair, could you just tell me again why?
It's not related to this bill, to the topic of voting, or anything to do with it.
But it's a constitutional amendment, and this is a constitutional amendment, Mr. Chair. And there's no germaneness ruling in
committee. Your amendment is out of order.
There's no germaneness ruling in committee, Mr. Chair. I would just ask counsel to confirm that. And Mr. Chair, I'd like a roll call vote on this.
Okay. To the 18 amendment, all those in favor say aye. And the roll call will.
Mr. Chairman. Chairman, I would agree with the roll call, but I would like to have the record be the vote recorded in the Journal of the Senate. We'll need three hands to approve that, Mr. Chair.
Three hands to record this in the Journal. Okay, we have the hand. Okay, the clerk will take the roll on the amendment.
Bandevere.
No.
Chamberlain?
No.
Eden?
Yes.
Harrington?
Yes.
Kielash?
Yes.
Cruz?
No.
Limmer?
No.
McGuire?
Yes. Yes.
Nelson?
No.
Peterson?
No.
Reiner?
Aye.
Roebling?
No.
Sieben?
Yes.
Wolf?
No.
Being eight no's and six yeses. That's correct. The amendment is not adopted. Any further amendments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could ask the Secretary of State's office to come forward and just comment on what they think the changes will produce for their office, because since they run the elections in the state of Minnesota, they could come up to the.
And we're not taking other testimony today,
Mr. Chair.
This point.
But you said we could ask questions. I'm curious what the Secretary of State thinks about this.
Okay, but then we're not. Division. If we don't get to amendments, then we know why.
Mr. Chair, this is a really important issue. This is a constitutional amendment that we're thinking of doing here. And I really do believe that we should have public testimony and ask questions of people that are absolutely affected by this.
We'll allow 1 minute to the Secretary of State.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Beth Fraser with the Office of the Secretary of State, and I appreciate Senator Newman's amendment in that he's trying to address some concerns that were raised at the last hearing. I am afraid that the amendments, though, actually make it significantly more confusing. I have no idea what a government-issued proof of identity is, and I know that the future legislature will decide what that is, but I can't even imagine what it would be. And changing the language from identical standards to having substantially equivalent standards of eligibility verification, again, I don't know what that means, and I can't imagine how we would even have substantially equivalent standards for absentee or mail ballot voters as people who come into the polling place. Senator Newman, earlier, what I heard was that Election Day registration would continue to be allowed, but that all Election Day registrants would have to vote by provisional ballot, which was news to me. That wasn't how I understood it, and would be a huge number of provisional ballots. It would mean that all of the 500,000-plus people who do Election Day registration in a presidential election year would have to not only provide proof of residence when they're registering, but then also go and show proof of identity when they're to get their ballot counted. And I believe that there are about 2.5 million provisional ballots cast nationwide in 2008. So adding 500,000 in just our state is an incredibly huge number. I don't know how this could be implemented without electronic poll books in all polling places, and so there's also a substantial cost involved.
Any other questions for Ms. Fraser? Senator Keeler.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Ms. Fraser, I made the suggestion that it's going to require more election judges in order to do this, especially with the provisional ballot. Am I accurate in that, based on what my local election officials tell me? The idea being that if you have a provisional ballot box, you have to have a judge from each side. And could you just discuss how many election judges that would be statewide and what the approximate cost would that be, and or if it's going to be necessary in all polling places or just some?
Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kulesh, what I've heard from the local election officials is that this definitely will require additional election judges because we're instituting a whole new process in the polling place, and they're going to need to be sure that people voting provisional ballots don't fill out their ballot and accidentally walk over and put it in the machine. They're going to have to instead sit with them, have them fill out their ballot, make sure the form is filled out correctly, and then put it into a separate ballot box. So I don't know exactly how many additional judges it would take, but it definitely would take additional election judges who are hired at the municipal level. And with 4,100 precincts in the state, you know, that's a sizable number of additions. The one other thing I forgot to say before about the confusion, or actually clarification, I guess, from the amendment is with the last version of the language, we were unclear about the impact on absentee voting. This amendment clarifies that it impacts absentee voting and that all absentee voters will have to have a government-issued photo ID in order to have their vote counted. So to the extent that it clarifies that it will impact absentee voters, that's helpful because we weren't sure before. But we are talking about 195,000 people in a presidential election year who vote absentee by mail, 11,500 military and overseas voters, and 45,000 people who are registered in mail ballot precincts. So we're talking about more than an additional 250,000 people will be impacted.
Wow. Senator Kulesh, could you have a follow-up?
Yeah, just to follow up on that, by mail ballot precincts, you're talking about precincts that only allow mail balloting, correct? And so what does that do to that particular precinct? What does this bill do to that particular precinct? Do they have to change their election?
Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kulesh, small jurisdictions around the state, those with fewer than 400 registered voters, are allowed to choose to instead of having different polling places around the neighborhoods, have mail all registered voters' ballots so that all the balloting is primarily done by mail unless somebody wishes to go to the county seat and cast a ballot in person. I have no idea how somebody who uses that process and who doesn't go into the county seat would provide government-issued proof of identity that's substantially equivalent to somebody who came into a polling place in another part of the state and had to show a government-issued photo ID. So I don't know how it would impact that.
Senator Kielash.
Yeah, just to, one of the things that concerns me is because it's a constitutional amendment, there's inflexibility in some of the things that doesn't matter what the next legislature would like to do or the new technology that comes up that may solve this issue. They're stuck with the language here, and some of the things that concern me are the, you know, everything from the within 10 calendar days. You know, does that mean that part of it is that it doesn't identify who you have to report to, those kinds of things. And yeah, maybe we can do some of that, but isn't that ripe for a lot of possible court challenges as to whether or not the next legislature is actually following the amendment if they create some kind of flexibility and the ability of different, you know, different parts of the state have different needs. What Hennepin County can do with a dense population is a lot more than what you can do in outstate rural Minnesota with a small population. So is this going to keep us from being flexible to allow different, processes or different ways that folks are voting around the state?
Fraser, would you like to continue speculating on what the Supreme Court will do?
Yes, I would love to, Mr. Yeah. Chair. I do think that it raises a lot of questions about, I can imagine that there would be challenges to whether what the next legislature comes up with meets these constitutional requirements and whether they are imposing substantially equivalent eligibility verification requirements on all voters. I also think that there are some other impacts that perhaps haven't been anticipated. So, for example, allowing voters 10 days to come back and get their provisional ballot counted or their absentee ballot counted will mean that we will probably have to move the primary even earlier in order to ensure that there's enough time to prepare ballots and get them out for the general election. Another impact, especially if we have more than 500,000 provisional ballots, is nobody's going to know who won any of the elections until at least 10 days or more afterwards. And so I know that people are on pins and needles on election night. Well, that feeling is going to last for quite a while if we don't know for more than 10 days who won anything in Minnesota from governor down to school board.
Senator Chamberlain.
I will. We'll get it back on track here. Senator Newman, earlier we were talking about provisional ballots and how it's now in this language, in this amendment, as opposed to the original language you had last week, I think, when we met. So my understanding was that the original language before this A-16 amendment, the provisional ballots were just assumed. It was assumed that that language would take care of provisional ballots the way it was written. That was our understanding. That was the intent. So all you've done here with the provisional language is just make that clear, that assumption in the last discussion we had that people had brought up, they had asked about that. What you're just simply doing here is clarifying that assumption and putting it in this new A-16 amendment. Is that correct?
Go ahead, Senator Newman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chamberlain, you are exactly correct. It is my view that the language in the A-16 amendment clarifies the legislative intent.
Thank you. Okay, further comments?
Then Mr. Chair, Reiner. I'm sorry, I thought I was on the list. Senator Newman, I want to, first of all, I applaud you. I think that If I were in your shoes, I would be defensive, if not sort of maybe even belligerent with the constant bombardment. So I'm glad I'm not. My question is to come back to what Senator Sieben was talking about and what I asked about way back when. And it really, as I look at your amendment, it kind of comes down to one word, and I'm just wondering if there's a philosophical ownership in that word, or and it's government issued versus first appears on 1.9 and then throughout, government issued versus government approved. And I guess, members, where I'm coming from is, you know, I'm a civics teacher. That's what I do in my real life. And this idea of voting being a right versus a privilege is kind of where I get stuck. And I feel like in that conversation, that exercising a right, the burden of proof should be on the government versus on the citizen to prove that they can exercise that right. So, you know, but I'm not naive. I know that this is important to you. I know that it's important to the majority. And, you know, as this moves forward, I offer this question for thought. And I actually did put together an amendment with the council's help. I'll ask for it to be shared, but I'm not going to move it because it's unfair in terms of process for you to just be seeing it with moments, for anyone on this committee just to be seeing it with moments. But as you move forward, I would ask you to take a look at it. I don't think it substantially changes what you're trying to do, but I do think it opens this door for other technologies that might get you where you're trying to go. And in particular, the video voter roll maybe as a possibility. And again, members, my concern is in that right versus privilege conversation, exercising a privilege, it's on us. Exercising a right, it's on the government. And we had this, it's odd, we had this very same conversation in Commerce this morning in terms of regulation and licensure. You know, who is the burden of proof on? And Mr. Chair, you were in that hearing as well. And the committee said it's on the government to impose that certification, that burden of proof. And I feel like the burden of proof on exercising a right or preventing one from exercising a right should be on the government. And, I mean, I'm not an attorney, so maybe I'm oversimplifying, which is kind of my job as a teacher to try and put it in words that we can all understand. And I just keep coming back to, I wonder if some small language changes fundamentally around government approved versus government issued might not go down that road. And, I'm interested in, again, I'm not, Mr. Chair, moving the amendment. I just offer it for consideration. And I'm interested in Senator Newman's thoughts on that. If there's a philosophical investment in that language, I respect that, but maybe there's not.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Senator Reinert. The answer is no. I am simply looking for a secure, verifiable identification process. You are the teacher. I can be taught. Maybe we'll sit down and we'll kick this around a little bit, I appreciate your comment.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Reinert, I would agree with you that voting is a right, but it is a conditional right. Unlike, let's say, our Bill of Rights, where you and I have the freedom of speech, freedom to vote is a conditional right. Take, for example, one of the conditions is you have to be at least 18 years of age. You have to be a citizen of the country. You have to be a resident of the local precinct that you live in. These are all conditions in order to vote. You have to be mentally competent. Our state constitution is very clear. Anyone who's not mentally competent and have been judged by a court cannot vote. You can't be a felon or serving any part of your sentence until your sentence is finally commuted. So those are all conditional rights, and it's I just wanted to step in here because I think sometimes we look at voting as an absolute fundamental right, and it is, but it does come with its conditions.
Mr. Chair, could I briefly respond?
Go ahead, Senator Ryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Limmer, completely respect your role, especially as our judiciary chair. And I acknowledge that it is a conditional right. One of the things we cover in class is not only is it a conditional right, but it's also a deferred. The federal government defers exercising that conditional right down to state governments, which is why we're having the conversation. I guess I just want to throw out that there might be more than one way to get there. And there might even be a way that people feel doesn't have the potential to disenfranchise, but actually enhances and makes our voting system a national model.
So, Mr. Chair, could I add to that? Senator Reiner, the reason I brought the discussion up is that you had stated that if it's a right deferred by the government, then it should be at our expense. And I'm not sure if that would fit entirely into a conditional right. And so I think that's why we're having the discussion. And since almost all of our citizens have some form of government-issued photo ID, with the exception of some estimates say about 140,000 people, that there is an assumed responsibility on the part of the citizen to participate and not necessarily have government do everything for you.
If you have amendments, I would suggest you offer them. Otherwise, any other questions? Senator Harrington.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, and actually following up on Senator Limiter's comments, I get the conditional right, the privilege. I get that argument. But this doesn't fundamentally get us there. That's my issue with this, is that this has been framed in terms of voter fraud. You made reference to Justice Stevens' statement that voter fraud exists. At the last committee hearing, there was testimony about thousands of cases of voter fraud. And I actually figured I'd take the time and look to find out what those thousands of cases were. So I called my friends over at Ramsey County. There were 1,554 cases referred in the 2008 period. Of that, 1,357 were felons voting. Now, being a felon doesn't mean you don't have identification. Most of the felons that are in my social service program, one of the first things we do is we go out and get them driver's licenses because we want them to be able to drive legally. So they would have a state-issued ID, and the voter ID bill will not stop 90% of what was alleged to be voter fraud, which was simply felons voting, and they're not allowed to. Their privilege to vote had not been restored. So 90% of the cases that have been talked about here just won't disappear at all by having voter ID. This is not going to change this even one iota. Of the remaining 100 or so cases, 94 were for double voting. Once again, if you vote in one precinct, vote in another precinct, but you have an ID, the ID is still going to be okay, and the voter ID isn't going to stop that 100 either. Eligibility, that might happen if your ID actually had date of births on it, because majority of those were folks that were underage that were voting. So once again, your ID, underage people have IDs, trust me. I worked as a cop around the college. There are a lot of IDs. There's no shortage of them that all show really interesting birth dates on them. The voter ID is not going to stop that from happening. Out-of-state residency cases, if we're issuing them IDs and they have a bill from a local place they live, once again, it's not going to stop that. So we're down to about 18 cases of misrepresentation of identity. 18 cases, and we're talking about spending millions of dollars for 18 cases. It doesn't seem like a particularly good use of the people's money. I'm opposed to this. I've said I was opposed to it before. I really haven't changed my position on this. But I was at a meeting the other day, and someone brought up Hubert Humphrey. Before my time, actually, I got to admit, I'm a relatively new Minnesotan. But he said that the moral test of government is how the government treats those who are at the dawn of life, our children, those who are in the twilight of life, the elderly, and those who are in the shadows of life, the sick, the needy, and the handicapped. This bill potentially disenfranchises all three. And for the 18 cases in Ramsey County that it would have prevented, it wipes out the potential for a much larger number of folks who have been voting and want to vote. And it doesn't stop the felons. who may vote by accident. And oh, by the way, of those felons, only in the tens, maybe 30 or 40 of them, were actually able to be charged, because when it actually got researched by the county attorney and the county sheriff's department, most of them weren't necessarily felons at the time they voted. They became felons afterwards, and so their right to vote was still good. It just got taken away post-voting period. So even then, even within the felons that could be charged, we're talking a microscopic number that could be charged. And I really urge you seriously to think about this. You know, why are we doing this? What is the need? What is the problem we are trying to solve? Because I don't think this bill gets us to what you really want, what I want, which is a voting system that has great integrity and that we can count on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your indulgence in our questions, and I, with all due respect, Senator Reinert, I think we've been thoughtfully questioning, and I think we should be thoughtfully questioning what this bill does and how it can happen. But I know that we still have Ms. Frazier up at the table. But so I was going to just ask her, and this refers to a question I asked, or I said that I was going to ask Senator Newman, which is, Ms. Frazier, the Secretary of State's office manages the state's elections. And so if there was fraud, and none of us want fraud in the voter system, we all are opposed to fraud in the voter system, would you say that your election judges would come to you if they thought there was a problem with fraud? Would you be a place that they would go? If an election judge saw that there should be a change, do you think that you might hear about it? Do they come to you with concerns about the process itself, whether it's fraud or not, like how it might be easier? I have great respect, Mr. Chair and members, for the election judges in my area. I mean, they are very serious about their work. They really pay attention. And, I mean, I've never heard from any of them about any concerns they've had. But I'm wondering, Ms. Frazier, if you've ever heard from any of them, whether, you know, what concerns they have that we haven't been able to address, or that this bill would address if there were concerns.
Ms. Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator McGuire. We do hear from election judges and from constituents frequently with, you know, suggestions and changes. But I think what we most often hear from election judges is how wonderful the experience was to serve in that way, and that it was really eye-opening because it helped them understand how many steps there are in the process and all of the checks that there are in the process. That when you just go in and say your name and sign the oath and are given a receipt and then your ballot and put it in the box, you're not necessarily aware of all of the other things that go on. And so I think that that's what we most often hear.
And so, Mr. Chair, if I could just follow up. So have you heard of a lot of cases of voter fraud in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Senator McGuire, no. Similar to Senator Harrington, what we have heard about are those who have been convicted of felonies voting before their civil rights have been restored. And the Task Force on Election Integrity, of which Senator Chamberlain and Senator Sieben are members, have really looked at that issue and will be coming forward with a bill to take concrete steps to address that issue in particular. But I think, as Senator Harrington said, this bill won't do anything, as far as I can tell, to address the issue of people voting before their civil rights are restored.
So then, Senator Newman, could you tell me who is it that brought this forward to you? Who came to you with this issue that is of such magnitude that we need to have a constitutional amendment about it? Have your election judges come to you, or who has come to you that has said, I mean, I know that we have a lot of anecdotal information out there, and most of it from other states, I might say, that we've heard in this committee that have not been in Minnesota. And so I take pride in our system in Minnesota, that we have a very, a system that is full of integrity and that we don't have a lot of fraud. And I am just wondering who it is that you're hearing from that might be from Minnesota that brings this issue forward to you.
Before we do that, Senator Newman, the Sergeant-at-Arms has asked me to remind the audience that there's no clapping or no displays allowed in the hearing room. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator McGuire, I have heard from constituents for years regarding voter fraud. and I don't think that I am unique in that. There are any number of senators and elected representatives that have heard from their constituents concerning voter fraud. I began my testimony today indicating that, you know, I could go into those anecdotal stories, but I am choosing not to because, you know, I'm not so sure that you're going to believe me when I tell you. But I'm simply saying that I have had constituents and friends and election judges talk to me about voter fraud that they have observed, and I'm just in a very small little Senate district. And while I have the microphone, Mr. Chairman, I do want, and while Ms. Frazier is sitting here, either she misspoke or I misspoke. But I do want to correct the record in terms of provisional voting, or I should say same-day registration. It was never my intent to have every new same-day registrant vote provisionally. If they show up with a proper identification, their vote should count.
Senator Limmer.
And thank you. It was never my intent otherwise.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator McGuire, I think you'd have to be living under a rock to think that the Minnesota people don't want voter ID. It's probably the number one issue that has been asked of me to represent in my district. A recent Star Tribune poll polled it as 85%. 65% of Democrats even want it, and a higher number of Republicans want it. Independents in high proportion want it. This has been on the news front for a long time. So if you're alluding to the idea that this is some fringe group that's somewhat nervous in some inappropriate way and that they don't have a right to bring an idea before the legislature, I think you might be wrong. But quite honestly, there's different civic organizations that are following this legislation on both sides of the issue. It's keen interest. We know that. Just showing the people that are in the room today and at the last one shows a keen interest. And Minnesotans don't always agree. But to think that we're going to deny the representation of even one of our citizens from bringing an idea forward in the legislature, and it's even more impactful when it's been polled by a legitimate news entity that it has high popularity, I guess I have to reaffirm. I just don't know where anybody's been if they haven't been following this issue.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kielash.
You have to let me respond, Mr. Chair. He's directly pointed this at me. Please,
Senator
Mr. Chair, you've got to let me address Senator Limmer's comments. Thank you. I appreciate that. Senator Limmer, yes, we've seen this. We've seen some of those polls, but I've seen polls that once when educated, the public is not supportive of this. Once they have an education of what this means, they're not educated. They're not in support of this. We've seen group after group of disenfranchised voters. I expect you've all heard from the students that I've heard from the senior citizens who are saying, wait a minute, this is not what we expected. This is not what we thought. And I have no problem with constituents bringing issues forward. I just don't want to see it in the Constitution. We just do not need a constitutional amendment on this. Senator Newman has every right to bring a legislation forward, but that is what we're here for. We're here to do legislation, not constitutional amendments. So this is a very drastic measure I do think it's a few people that want this to happen, because when educated, most people do not feel that this is important. So,
On that point, Mr. Chair, Senator McGuire, if this is passed, and if it's passed relatively soon, we would have the entire state would have an opportunity to discuss this issue. Your side can point out all of the fallacies that you think are in the merits of this particular bill. The other side will be promoting and advocating for it. I think sometimes it's better to leave some issues up to the public to decide. And rather than think that we're so elite that we can do all of their thinking and rationalizing on our own for them. This is an issue that this process is guaranteed by the Constitution. It's not something that, as you say, we shouldn't be doing it. We are allowed to present this to the public. This is a policy that we would offer to the public to give us direction on. And that's as simple as it is. I think you're being a little too harsh on this.
Senator Cruz, we're running out of time.
Mr. Chairman, I know we're kind of getting close to taking a vote here, and I want to commend you for your leadership in this committee. I think you've been extremely flexible and fair, and I appreciate the discussion. I guess knowing that we're getting close to a vote, I'd like to request a roll call when we do take that vote.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. A roll call will be called.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just briefly to respond to Senator Limmer's points about this, I recognize that the public opinion polls say that Minnesotans support this. One problem that I know is irritating to Senator Newman and perhaps others on the committee is that those of us here are trying to tease out what the implications are for passing this language. And I have so many that I know some of them we already covered, but let me just give one example. AARP and others in the last hearing brought up the example of how vouching is commonly used in nursing homes currently. And I think in your bill last year, Senator Limmer, there were provisions made that would still allow for vouching to occur in nursing homes. And I think that that was certainly the right move on this committee's behalf to make vouching allowable. But I do think that it's a legitimate question to ask, for instance, whether vouching would be allowable under the constitutional amendment. Because you say, well, if this passes and we put this out to the voters, both sides will have time to educate the public. But that's not really the truth we can't fully educate the public because both sides will spin their side the way they want to say, this won't allow vouching, this still will allow vouching, this doesn't allow Election Day registration, this does allow Election Day registration, this may, we know now it will create provisional balloting, but we don't know if Election Day registration will be subject to provisional balloting. We don't know if supporting documents would be paid for by the state to allow people to get photographic IDs. So, again, I just go back to that perhaps we need to slow down on moving forward a constitutional amendment because there are things that we could talk about to try to make it more clear to the public about what the implications of this would be. So, to direct a question at Senator Newman, then, I guess I would just ask you, under this language, do you foresee an opportunity or a mechanism where vouching would still be allowed in some cases, for instance, at nursing homes where many senior citizens perhaps don't have current identification cards because they're expired? You know, would a expired ID still be allowable? Or would the state be obliged to provide everyone with a new ID because vouching wouldn't be allowed? I mean, let's just take the case of nursing homes. What do you foresee, Senator Newman, would be the implications for voters in nursing homes?
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sieben, I believe that this constitutional amendment will effectively render the vouching system moot, and I also believe that this constitutional amendment will provide for the legislature in the future to address the questions that you are raising.
So, okay, we'll close the debate on the bill, and Senator Limmer renews his motion that Senate File 1577 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on State Government, Innovation, and Veterans. A roll call being requested. The assistant will take the roll.
Van Duer.
Yes.
Chamberlain.
Yes.
Eaton.
No.
Harrington.
No.
Kielosch.
No.
Cruz.
Yes.
Limmer.
Yes.
McGuire.
No.
Nelson.
Yes.
Peterson.
Yes.
Reinert.
No.
Roebling.
Yes.
Sieben.
No.
Wolf.
Yes.
There being 8 ayes and 6 nays, the bill is passed and re-referred. With that, I think we've concluded our business on the agenda today. And
where does this go? Where does this go? State government? Office of Education.